Welcome to the Futile Podcast, and tonight it's Ian and
Jeff,
and we're going to talk about Ridley Scott's *The Martian*. Maybe delve into a few other things. Just going to kind of discuss some futile podcasteries, I suppose. It's another term I made up. I do like that I say, not to get like too meta. This might be kind of a meta episode, I think, which is fine, but. I've always liked that I said, and tonight. And that used to be a thing that like you'd hear like comedians or whatever do podcasts about, and be like, oh, their fans get mad at him for saying that or something. And I'm like, you know what? Who cares?
Yeah, there's some sayings like that that I think they'll stick just because they worked. Like, tune in, you know, all kinds of like sayings like that are better to, you know, dead technologies or dead methods or whatever. I think they'll still stick around for our generation, at least. For sure. I would assume you're in your late 30s like I am, so it's, I don't know, maybe a little different for us, but, you know, I remember what a rotary telephone was and all those sort of things.
Right. A little backstory for you, I suppose. How did you start listening to the Futile Podcast? And what other podcasts do you like? Do you listen to?
Let's see. I think I first heard your name, I think, when you guested on Paul Chapman's podcast. And I think I kind of just latched onto some of the same, maybe hatred's too strong a word, but some of your disses on Prometheus, which I think is a little bit similar to, you know, what we're talking about tonight. But I think that's the first time I had heard about you, and you know, I followed Paul on Twitter, and then just eventually started listening to you. And let's see, in regards to your second comments, I mean, I listened to you. I listened to Paul a little bit. He's gone a little more towards the anime route, which I'm not into, but you know, less 80s, 90s movies that I think. I first heard about his podcast when my son was born, and I was just, you know, feeding him and doing all kinds of dad time stuff where you just kind of need something to bide your time. And
right.
I want to say I just searched iTunes for Tango and Cash, and it popped up on the first page, his podcast for Tango and Cash, and then it was a love story ever after, so...
That's great.
Other podcasts, I mean, really the only thing I listen to is... I listen to Film Junk. I used to listen to the Film Drunk Fraughtcast, which is a little more, it's a little more comedy than it is like talking about movies and whatnot, but
right.
I don't listen to them as much anymore. And then I listen to James Bonding, but that's kind of sporadic. That's Matt Gourley's podcast with Matt Myra, where they basically just talk all James Bond stuff, which is fun. Other things, I guess Pistol Shrimps Radio is pretty entertaining with, that's another Matt Gourley thing. So, I don't know. I think all the universes are kind of connected as far as I see it, so.
Yeah, there's a level of that. I mean, I'm. Let's see, this is entering into the ninth year of doing this, sort of intermittently, as it were. And I kind of still do have that weird, like little guy mentality about it, you know, because it's become really replete. Like, there are a lot. The marketplace has become oversaturated with a lot of, I don't know, I guess comedians and actors and people trying, just doing it because it's cheap, it's quick, and it's almost like something they have to do for their career, you know?
Yeah, it's low-hanging fruit for sure when something like, how did this get made, like, pops up, like, I don't know, it seems like it's new, like, in the last couple years new, but I feel like, you know, that concept, you know, was already underground, but it just didn't have comedians behind it. So I hear you.
Yeah. And I don't know. I tried that one out. I tried their Tango and Cash one out, and like 10 minutes into them, 10 minutes into them kind of like discussing it, like seriously, I was like, aren't these comedians? Aren't they going to have fun with this movie, which you clearly should have fun with? I'm like, this isn't really all like, and I just kind of gave up on it. Like, honestly, I was just like, nope. Okay. If they're just going to make fun of the people making the movie more than like I don't know, it just seemed like they didn't get it or something.
I agree. I was just about to say that. I think sometimes they just don't get it, but you know, I mean, I watched Bloodsport recently, and and that's a 5 out of 5. Like, non-ironically, I have so much fun watching a what they would say is an awful movie, but, like, you know, as much fun as I have just watching something like that, they get stuck on, is Chong Li have a hearing impairment problem, and things like that that they, like, just kind of get off on. But I don't know. It's still entertaining to a degree, but yeah, I don't listen to them as much. I'd rather just listen to, you know, more movie focused things that have comedy in them rather than comedy first.
Right. I like that too, kind of. And when there's no contamination with the industry, I suppose, you know, like the Film Junk guys are very sincere and fun. That was the first podcast I started listening to. Just kind of found it one day on a search when I was going on a road trip.
Yep.
And to this, I mean, I've listened to them enough now that I really get a lot out of their reviews. Like, I know when I can kind of take one seriously, or when I, like, I can gauge it to the point where, like, okay, these guys are all loving this movie. I'll probably, like, this is probably like a 3.5 for me, and it's a 5 for them.
Right.
Did you discover Film Junk through, how did you find them?
Let's see. It was, I actually don't remember the genesis of that. It might have been either in part or in whole through you. It might have been. Like, I think sometimes you just kind of get tapped out, or you run through your, you know, your to-do, your to-listen-to list, and once you're empty, you kind of just search. But another one I forgot to mention, Rope of Silicon, had a pretty good podcast back in the day. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. They had a short-lived site by, you know, some proper movie reviewers who, like, you know, go to Cannes and, like, get paid to review movies and stuff. Wow. And with, I think the guy's name was Brad and Laramie. And they were pretty good. But I think it was mostly just through search results, or, you know, seeing what other people were talking about. So
yeah, I always retweet their when their podcast's out and stuff. So that's kind of, they're one of the few people I still sort of throw my considerable social networking cachet behind whenever I can, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because I only have guested on Paul's show once, and that was the Prometheus one that was kind of slapdash and thrown together. And yeah, I don't remember saying too much, because, you know, I know he had Rachel on, and she had plenty to say. Yeah. And I think I was just getting back from a wedding, so I was really tired. And all I can remember saying, which I still think is a good point, having revisited Prometheus, I can say that I'm maybe just a little less burned by it. Like, I'm like, it's not, whatever. Like, I don't think that the bad things are good now or anything, or better, but I think it's just less, I'm less worn by it.
Yeah, I can see
but
that.
But still, like, I think maybe the only decent point I tried to at least make on that podcast was that a sign of the sort of, I don't know, sloppy or lazy writing was in when the character takes his helmet off.
Sure.
Willy-nilly, like, you know, it's like you're doing a suspenseful science fiction story. Like, you could have just very quickly written in a rationale where he panicked and, you know, the music goes high and he has to take his helmet off. But instead you write this character that's just so idiotic that he's just going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And that to me was where I think I said, I think I felt disappointed in the writing, you know, that it just didn't feel like it needed to at least do that little bit better. Something that, like, I could think up in 5 minutes or less, you know?
Yeah.
And that's usually where my biggest criticism of stuff comes. And sometimes that's not the highest thing. Like, you know, with the new Star Wars movie, certain elements being, you know, certain ways. But I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too old school. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm the ornery old man with reviews at this point.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting more cynical too. And even with a movie like The Martian, I feel like I, you know, went the same kind of route that I think Paul kind of attacked Prometheus. I feel like I probably appreciate Prometheus more after a couple watches. I did not like it on the very first one. I was a little annoyed, maybe just because my expectations were a little too high for a alien level prequel directed by Scott. So I don't know. I feel like that opinion is pretty rampant, that you know, a lot of people loved it, and a lot of people you know, also had problems with characters and taking helmets off and all that kind of stuff as well. That seems like the go-to complaint.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just such an easy way to point out, like, the, I don't know, the one dimensionality of some of at least that one character. I mean, then there's interesting stuff with the other ones, but you know, whatever. Anyway, so tonight, I guess we'll talk about Ridley Scott's The Martian, which I had not seen when it came out or anything. I was only vaguely interested in it at the time because Ridley Scott, I know, is getting up there, but he's still keeping busy, but he seems to be still very diversified and not quite as focused on a handful of properties that I think all of us nerds are all interested in him doing, you know, or being involved with, like the Blade Runner sequel, like follow-ups to the Prometheus and stuff. You know, it's like, if you're gonna do this stuff, you're gonna do this stuff. It's like, no, he's gonna do The Martian, and then he's gonna do, I mean, didn't he do another like weird Egypt fantasy movie too? Did he do that?
Yeah,
Gods of Egypt.
That was so bad I turned it off, but I will say I did like The Counselor. I know a lot of people shit on that movie, but I really enjoyed The Counselor. I felt like the characters and everything from it in regards to that plot and just like how bad something can go wrong was actually a really good story. So I feel like that's the last really good thing he did, in my opinion. But yeah, Exodus Gods and Kings or something like that was a total snoozer. So hated it.
Yeah, it didn't look that great. It's like he always feels... And then, you know, he did doing stuff like Robin Hood and stuff. I don't know. It's like he feels like he has to do those kinds of movies that are big, maybe because he's one of the few people that still can. And then they're just, I mean, maybe they make money. I don't know. Because it's like, it's throwback to old big epics from a long time ago. But
yeah, it could be a passion.
Yeah, I don't know.
Could be a passion project. I think at the beginning of that, it was like a, this one's for Tony kind of sentiment. I don't know. Maybe he had some sort of fascination with Egypt or Ben-Hur, something along those lines. And maybe there's some background to it, but I didn't like it enough to Google that.
Yeah, it might have just been the timing or something, you know?
Sure.
Which is the unfortunate timing of that. So, okay, so I haven't read the book for The Martian. And just to kind of do a 20-second plot, because like it's an easy enough plot, which I think is a good thing. And plot is usually boring. We usually don't like to talk about plot on Feudal Podcasts. We just jump in and you've either seen it or you haven't, and we're going to spoil it. We're going to talk about everything.
That's right. Spoilers.
That's how it goes. Yeah, spoilers and whatnot. So it's based on a book. It's set in kind of a weird fantasy, not too distant future type of thing, almost like Her or something like that, where, hey, the space program is back. It's almost set in an alternate reality, like 2025.
Yeah.
Because I know that 2025 is not going to be The Martian. And I know they mentioned the Pathfinder, and so that was 1996 or something. I don't know if they ever actually put a date to how long ago that. I think he just mentions the date of Pathfinder and never grounds the story in a given date. But maybe, and I don't remember like there being a title card. I might have missed something. I don't know.
There wasn't. I didn't catch it. I mean, I rewatched this like Wednesday night, and then but last night I turned on the special features just to see if there was any other insight I can glean. And they say 2030s, 2040s, but it's non-specific. But yeah, there's a couple callbacks in the dialogue to, like, Sean Bean tells the Chinese people, we haven't used this since 2009 or something like that. And then the Pathfinder stuff, too. So they kind of ground it like that. But by not saying that, they're kind of not, you know, dating it so much so that if anybody watches it in 2030, they'll say, this is ridiculous. We thought we were going to be, yeah. putting people on Mars. So anyways,
and in November of 2019, it's not going to be Blade Runner, so I guess we already got to watch that one out, huh?
Right.
There just is people on Mars doing a space mission, like, you know, like NASA might have planned, and then things go awry and one of them gets stuck kind of in a Wizard of Oz like fashion, gets drawn up in a hurricane, and they think he's dead, and they rush off and escape and leave him there, and turns out he's not. And then it's basically just about him surviving and then reconnecting with everybody back on Earth, and then the kind of drama that goes about how to handle things on both his side trying to survive and on NASA's side trying to sort of manage the PR / actual situation. It's got elements of an Apollo 13 kind of quality to it.
Yep. kind of,
which I like.
I think it kind of culls from lots of stuff, and I think that's one of the things I kind of disliked about it, was that I feel like I'd seen everything, bits and pieces of it, like, I feel like I'd seen them done before, as well as, like, done better, even by Scott. I mean, some of the, you know, so the storm, the all the tech stuff is very, very Prometheus, very alien universe. So, and then same thing, kind of Castaway stuff, you know, your average survival story.
The first thing I noticed is the font. So I'm thinking, like, this is probably just an alien Prometheus prequel, you know? So why not? So this is the Prometheus prequel. We got that dialed in. It fits within the universe just fine, I suppose. They didn't mention anything about Weyland Yutani, or so. That's probably the background there somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know.
behind the NASA.
The Predators
propaganda.
Have already been running around like the Pacific Northwest at this point by 2030, right? If we follow the whole the Praelian universe or whatever you want to call it, then Predators have been running around the Pacific Northwest, and they already nuked, I don't know, what was it, like Portland or something?
Yeah, I kept thinking it would intersect more with the interstellar universe, where that's how Matt Damon got stranded on that planet or something. I don't know, I feel like this is begging for a supercut of because it's so similar, you could almost like interweave parts of it together with other things. But yeah, I think at its heart, it's just a very simple survival story that had a lot of stuff I had already seen before. So I mean, that's my one sentence review of it.
Right.
But I liked it. I didn't love it. I definitely liked it a lot more. I think I watched this with my wife. I wasn't super interested in seeing it, I think, kind of like you, but. She wanted to see it, so I was like, yeah, you know, this is a good one I can go see. And I liked it in the theater, but upon rewatch, I think it dropped a good bit. I think more just because I was just, you know, like I said, cynical old man by now. I'm trying to poke holes in all the things that I didn't like or that I had seen before, and just being snobbish, but that's just me.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I went into it just like with like Sicario and a few other films that I sort of blind bought when they were, you know, they fell below the ever precious $10 Blu-ray Amazon thing or something. And I'm like, I've heard mostly positive things about these. I might as well get it and see if I like it. And I figured I would, you know, because I do like that survival story. I mean, to me, the most interesting stories are, you know, the journey of, you know, a person versus nature kind of thing. Like, and there's elements of that here, obviously. I do think that it hand waves a few things, which, you know, is fine. And it gets into other dramatic things that I don't know that I care so much about. And then on thinking about it, this didn't really occur to me the first time I watched it, but they mention his parents, but I don't think we ever see his parents. And there's no real sense of him having, like, people home, or, you know, like, does he have a wife, does he have children? I don't think we ever get any of that. He's very much like a man alone in a lot of ways. We get more from like the other crew who have to decide to go back or not, you know, like, oh well, our families are gonna have to wait that much longer and everything else.
They definitely didn't cover that. I feel like they, like I said, I watched the special features, and one of them was just it re-showed the trailer, and I think the way they cut up the trailer was like you see Michael Pena's wife and kid on, you know, a video conference with him, but they cut it like Matt Damon is talking to him and putting his hand on the monitor. So it's like they felt like that was important to some degree, but I feel like the writer just wanted to have a cool like survival story that's all about like interesting problem solving. So they kind of just, I don't think that was the intent, to bring a bunch of emotion or a bunch of, you know, baggage like that. I mean, they almost didn't even really need to put that scene with him talking to Jessica Chastain's character about tell my parents, you know, I love what I do, or whatever he was telling them, because I don't know, that never felt like part of it to me.
No, I know what you mean. It becomes it's a tricky thing, because like I could get behind the idea of like just one guy never says anything, just solving problems constantly, and there's no sense of his, you know, greater depth of humanity kind of thing. But I think when they start hinting at it with other characters and things, then it sort of starts to feel like it's lacking for him in a weird way. That's all oddly sort of convenient, because then he starts to feel more like he just is there to be like a device for solving problems in that aspect of the plot, maybe. he's less of a character, even though he, you know, he has a sense of humor and everything else, which feels, I don't know, a little put on. One of my notes was the way the movie starts, I feel like it's very quick and almost kind of Sorkin-esque with the jokey banter between all these astronauts, you know, while they're on Mars. And then, like, the storm hits and then everything happens. And I don't know, for me, like, if you really start being nitpicky, and not even all that nitpicky from a plot standpoint, you're like, so they were, like, they didn't plan on, like, a Mars storm coming by and forcing them to have to get the hell out of there, and they like have 2 minutes to figure everything out. Like, it all seems very convenient for forcing the situation that they need to have happen, which is that somebody gets left behind. And in that sense, I was kind of critical of that. And I almost felt like, you know what, it could have been a better movie. And this is something that you can always do when you watch a script, or watch a script, you know, when you think about a script while you're watching a movie, it could have just been maybe been stronger to just kind of almost like fade in with him waking up, you know, after the storm, and you don't have to ask all those questions, and you get a sense of the other crew members enough later on that you maybe didn't need to see any of their sort of jokey interactions or any of that. Just start with him and then try to maybe stay with him as much as you can. I mean, I thought some of the problem solving stuff on the other side was interesting. The Jeff Daniels character, I think, was effective as being sort of the closest thing to an antagonist in the story, but still you understood everything he was doing. Like, from the point of view of like a director, it's like, look, if we have somebody die on live television, then we're gonna, you know, we can't do this ever again. So all of his logic and his rationale, like, there was at least sensibility there. It wasn't just like, oh, I'm an evil, greedy corporate guy or something like that.
Yeah, those are all fair points. I think what you're touching on, like, I feel like I was kind of rolling my eyes maybe a little during the beginning, you know, hearing the crew speak, which was very like Whedon-y and a little unnecessary. But the more the movie like kept going, I was just like, all right, well, this is pretty much a comedy set in a sci-fi problem solving, you know, device or whatever. And I think that's just what its intent was. It's just a question of whether you like that kind of stuff. I don't like that kind of stuff where every Avenger talks the same or talks like Tony Stark with, you know, all being super witty. I don't think that's as naturalistic or, you know, unique, but, I don't know. That was one thing that kind of bugged me, especially on a rewatch. It's fine if Matt Damon has a personality and he's a smart ass that keeps the pace going and everything and makes it entertaining. But when everybody does it, it seems just kind of like, you know, what's the point?
Yeah, there's not a lot of difference between the crew in that sense. I mean, they're from different backgrounds, whatever, sort of, but you don't really get, I mean, they mentioned, Jessica Chastain's character mentions that her and Michael Peña's character are both military people, but you don't really get that they're, like, maybe a little more hard-ass. She, maybe a little bit, just because of the default of being, like, the captain and having to make the tough decisions. But he seems just like as jokey as, you know, as the rest of them and stuff. So you're right. It is that kind of thing where, I mean, the thing I have trouble with is there's not a lot of, and you know me, I love the bitter work type of thing. And there is a sense of that in this movie, but there's also not a lot of sense of like all of these, and astronauts are awesome. Fine. I get it. You know, the right stuff, kick ass. There's some, you know, minuscule percentage of the population that are just literal superhuman beings. But it isn't necessarily, like, you can only handle so much of that. And it's like everyone's just on it. Everyone's just cool. Nobody really ever makes any mistakes, really. I mean, he makes that one mistake with the not accounting for the oxygen early on. And that was kind of good because it was like, oh, yeah, he rushed into something and whatever. But there isn't, I don't know, I guess you never feel that much tension because you never see any kind of sense of flaw or vice. I mean, he crushes that Vicodin onto that potato, but then you never get a follow-up that like, oh, because he did that, you know, now he's constipated and he weighs too much to actually effectively, and now he has some weird scene where he has to make himself puke. I mean, I don't know.
That'd be great.
Yeah, right? You know, like really get to, you see him kind of lose it a little bit, but never that much, and you get, okay, that this is a story about, you know, badasses, just being badasses. And okay, fine. But some of that survival stuff that's interesting is interesting when it's not like melodramatic, you know, like crying because you're not going to see your kids again kind of thing. But like the real like existential man versus nature kind of, you know, barbaric yelp type of shit, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think is going to, it would hit just about anyone. So in that sense, I don't know. It did to me, seem to me like, I think in my Letterboxd review, I sort of tried to make a point of mentioning it as being kind of both kind of a propaganda piece and kind of a fantasy piece, because everything kind of works out all right. This is about good, strong, powerful people that solve, they work the problem and they solve the problem and they do the math and they don't, you know, screw up on the units, unlike what happens with real NASA.
Yeah,
and
how many times did they have to say that? They're like, we ran the numbers, we did the math. I'm like, why don't you show me doing the math? Explain this to the layman somehow with the, you know, some sort of example. I'm like, they keep saying that like it's just as a shortcut, I guess, so they don't have to explain it. But I'm sure, I mean, that's definitely complex subject matter to communicate, but either way, I feel like they said that multiple times. Yeah, we did the math. Yeah, it worked out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I could follow enough of the stuff with like him being a botanist and figuring out how to grow potatoes, and I liked the thing with Pathfinder and the communication thing. I don't know hexadecimal, but I can at least follow that that's a way to communicate, you know, as a system. So that to me seemed like good problem solving. I don't think I had any real issue with the problem solving. Of course, you're right. There's a lot of shorthand and, oh, why don't we just do this and stuff? And you kind of get ahead of the story a few times, like I did with the crew being like, well, why don't they just go back and pick him up? Doesn't that maybe make more sense? I mean, I know there's probably like realities about like how much fuel they have and everything else, but
yeah, I think in my head, I was just nitpicking a little too much in regards to how cross-trained are astronauts. I was like, well, is he an astronaut? Is he a scientist first? Or is he a botanist first? I'm like, well, you know, pick or choose. Like, he knew how to do a whole lot of stuff, and he had a whole lot of background knowledge for where Pathfinder was buried and all that kind of stuff. I'm just like, well, and I kind of had that problem watching Gravity, too, I think. Like, I don't remember exactly what Sandra Bullock's character specifically was, but she wasn't like the pilot. That was more like Clooney's role or whatever. She was like a computer nerd or someone who wouldn't be able to, you know, do all that kind of stuff unless she was extremely cross-trained in very complex stuff. So I don't know. It has problems in shorthand sometimes, but
yeah, no, I think that that's a fair point. And then, of course, you just have to wonder. I mean, they're probably, obviously, they probably are extremely cross-trained, and they're like, you know, the highest end of people. I mean, they have to go through a lot to be able to do what they do. And then the reality of, you know, like certain dramas that have happened with actual astronauts in the real world is kind of unfortunate and things like that, you know, like the crazy lady that drove across the country or whatever. Anyway, yeah, I don't know how I feel about it, because part of it is definitely, it was very, very much a like throwback Hollywood, like make everybody feel good about, look at, we all came together and solved the problem. And even the tertiary cast members are like people you recognize from popular TV shows and stuff like that.
Oh yeah. I love the girl from Halt and Catch Fire. She's, I don't know. She just seems really natural with either, you know, being a programmer on that show or explaining complex stuff. I don't know. And she's just, I don't know. She's just kind of cute. Like, she's very likable. Same thing with Chewie. What's his name? I can never pronounce it, so I'll just call him Chewie.
You've got Kublai Khan from in it, and you've got Donald Glover, and you've got Kristen Wiig showing up just to, I guess, be there as like the head of the PR department for NASA.
Yeah,
or something.
Not a big fan of her in this. I feel like she was kind of wasted too. You know, she's supposed to be the funny one, but I felt like Jeff Daniels had more funny moments aside from the people on Earth.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know. It probably could have been about 20 minutes shorter, like everything. I say that about almost everything in a few places. But, I mean, it was engaging, and I was compelled by the survival story of it. I mean, even in these movies, you still retain a sense of, at least, I don't know, part of the illusion is that, like, there's still tension there at all, you know, like, maybe he won't make it, I don't know, maybe they'll do that, it's like, they're probably not gonna do that, you know, person's not gonna, I mean, in Gravity, I felt like that was more of a potential, and Gravity, I think, was a much more intense story, right all the way up to, like, the very end, you know, and then, like, then she gets out of the water, and it's like, holy shit, wow,
yeah,
okay.
I kind of kept waiting for that moment in this, even though there was tons of, like, you know, bad disco jokes or whatever just throughout it. I kept thinking like it would have some really amazing set piece or something at the end that would be like, you know, your one memorable thing about this survival movie. You know, I feel like Gravity, the first, you know, whatever, 15 minutes of that when the, whatever it is, the debris hits the satellite they're on was like amazing. And I feel like Castaway, you know, I'm trying to think of other survival movies that have that one moment, like I feel like the plane crash on Castaway, you know, stuff like that. Apollo 13, all of them kind of had their moments, and this one just kind of, maybe it was just like less ambitious, and again, I think it was just trying to make it fun, lighthearted, and you know, because they did it that way, it, you know, they didn't have to reach a higher, you know, altitude or whatnot. They didn't have to, you know, push the limit.
Yeah, and in some ways I suppose that's kind of refreshing, that it's like, it's not trying to take itself so seriously, so you can still have fun with it. It's well made, it's well executed, it's all, you know, it's kind of paint by numbers, but there's something almost kind of, I certainly, like, for me, like, almost a little comforting about a movie like that every now and again, where everything doesn't have to be so dire and so high tension, you know, especially with all the prestige television always kind of relying on that these days, you know, where it's like everything is unreliable, faulty narrators, and difficult people in scary situations. It's like, eh, this is just a story about a bunch of really smart people that are kind of jokey, figuring out how to solve a problem that's pretty dire. But hey, wouldn't it be great if this was how the world really was and how people really were? And, you know, they'd have their foibles, but they'd figure out how to work together and save the day, win the day, as it were. So I don't know. I'll admit fully that, like, I was very aware of all of that, but I found it kind of comforting too. And I think in my Letterboxd review, I was kind of out and out. I was like, yes, this is a pretty clear sort of propaganda piece for a world that we don't live in right now and probably never will. And that's sad, but oh well, you know, it would be awesome if we had a whole bunch of kick-ass types of people that were like super cross-trained astronauts out there pushing the boundaries of what we will accomplish as a species, as opposed to us just, you know, lighting each other on fire in cities and stuff.
Yeah.
maybe it'll cycle back through and we'll end up with some kind of weird optimism again. And, you know, not to get too existential, but it sort of begs those questions, at least to me, but everything sort of does to me. I like that in this world, back to the fantasy world aspect of it, the Chinese are super cool with cooperating with us and just sharing some of, apparently they've got some hidden technology too.
Yeah, I feel like they pulled that from Contact. It's like, oh yeah, wait, Americans, you know, blew themselves up. Let's let the Chinese figure it out. They'll save the day.
Right. And would they actually save the day is the real question, that, like, the more cynical version of me is like, I don't know.
Yeah,
they would give
from
a shit,
every
you know?
60 minutes episode I watch, I would say the answer is no. They would let us die. So,
yeah, I made a note about it. It's like, you know, at this point, we might as well ask the goddamn Russians to help us. You know? Like,
yeah, may as well. Yeah.
Who's to say? Yeah,
let's leave our fate
to
the North Koreans.
I didn't really like the, I mean, because so much of the movie lived within a sort of fantasy realism, I guess, would be the weird kind of oxymoronic term of it. So that by the time it got to the end, I think it just started to accumulate enough, like, okay, if you rip everything off this thing and you shoot it up, and then you're going to have to jump off of it, and then you're going to cut something in your arm, and it became too many, like, they sort of stacked too many things against them to the at the end to, like, arrive at this, like, Michelangelo's, you know, or Sistine Chapel moment, you know, of Chasten just barely catching him kind of thing. And I thought, like, some of that was kind of harrowing and engaging, but I feel like the execution of it and maybe the visual effects of it were just they looked very, it seemed very artificial, probably because they hadn't done hardly any space stuff in the movie, and it seemed too clean or something. And it just, like, I'm like looking back at Mars and I'm like, maybe that's one of those weird cases where, like, that's what that would really, really look like, you know, it would look that clean or whatever, but it just, it didn't, it didn't work for me, and it kind of took me out at that point. And I was, but of course, by then it was essentially a foregone conclusion. Like, this is the end of the story, you know, play the David Bowie.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's the scene they thought maybe was going to be like what you remember about it, the Iron Man stuff. But I was a little tired of the, you know, references like that. That again, that seemed very very Whedon-y. All these references, like Matt Damon calling himself, you know, names. I'm the greatest botanist. I'm Iron Man. I'm Captain Blondebeard or whatever. You know, all those sort of things. I felt like that should have been, you know, the gravity level scene where, you know, it's silent and it's scary. But I think up to that point, they hadn't really, you know, given you a dire enough tone to make you think that she wasn't going to catch him. She was going to catch him. He was going to get home.
Yeah, exactly. And so they probably, like I said, they just kind of cranked the schmaltz up there and the cheese factor. And yeah, you're right. I did kind of get a kick out of that maritime thing and the pirate thing. But at the same time, I was also like, it's just another example of these guys just being, everybody just being the smartest guy in the room kind of thing. It's like, really? Would you be all that aware of all of that stuff?
Yeah, I'd be rolling. I was rolling my eyes by then, for sure.
But I don't know. Sometimes, like I said, it is definitely in the Hollywood movies, they have the awesome character type thing. And there's like eight Mary Sues in this movie, to borrow a phrase. Yeah. And I guess they kind of balance each other out maybe a little. It would be nice to have seen a little more flaw, a little more issue, but not in a melodramatic way. And that's usually how Hollywood treats it, you know? Like, it's like, what if one of the astronauts was like a drug addict and that's why the whole thing happened, and then he's trying to hide it the whole time and then finally has to admit it and then cries and sacrifices himself to save Matt Damon? It's like, fuck off. I already just figured all of that out. And
yeah, they try to say a lot of serious stuff like, hey, they made like a big point of, hey, we're not going to tell the crew that he's still alive because space is, yes, they were like, space is dangerous and, you know, they need to pay attention to their mission. But I mean, in reality, you know, they show the crew, you know, 10 minutes later and they're like working out and video conferencing their families and all this. I'm like, it doesn't seem very serious to me. Seems like that satellite station was pretty cush.
Yeah, they were pretty chill. Yeah, that looked like the place to be, honestly. You know, it was like like something out of the Venture Brothers or something.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, man, you know, rock the bossa nova music and everybody just hang out at the tiki bar here on space station. And then they get to the end and all that. And you see, I guess, later on, it cut to the next mission. People are going back and you see where all these different characters are, and you don't really get a sense of the real consequences for the actions that they've had.
Yeah, I was talking about court-martials, and then they were like, she was like, I guarantee you'll get court-martialed. They'll never let you go back up again. And then, you know, all that's undone, and you see Michael Peña, you know, yeah, he's back. And I'm like, well, okay.
Which seems less likely, because he was the one that they made a point of saying has like an actual family. So he was out for a really long time and then turned around. And
I don't think he loves his family at all. I don't think Kate Mara loved her baby either. That actually kind of bothered me. I was like, all right, well, they're showing, you know, the credits. And I kind of like that style, like how they rolled the credits and showed you a little bit while the music's rolling of what everybody was doing after everything, you know, years later. But, you know, Bucky and Kate Mara, you know, just had a baby like that day, and she like looks at it for 1 second, kisses it, and then like watches the space shuttle take off. I'm like, really?
Yeah, exactly. I think that was, I mean, that's where you kind of get the point that it's sort of hokey, I suppose. And I think Jessica Chastain's character, she was just like getting back from a run or something and watching it on TV, so you know she's not there, she's not part of it, so she probably had some consequences. Sean Bean's character, I think, is in a strange way is kind of the hero of the story. And I did like his little tag, you know, his little National Lampoon's Animal House tag, where everyone else is watching the next thing happen. And he's been shit canned from NASA because he was the one that like essentially made sort of the tough decisions and sort of made the right calls. Like, look, we're going to inform everybody and let them make up the decisions that they think is correct. You know, like, I'm going to give my crew real transparency and say, because he was like the mission control guy. And then it's just him like, you know, playing golf with his son. And he's just like, yeah, it's a nice shot. You know, he's not even watching the space. He's just done with it. And in a weird way, part of me thinks like that makes him the most heroic. But there's also something kind of invariably tragic about that, because everyone else is sort of still connected to NASA and the space program. Like, they went through this harrowing event, and then they're all still there for, like, we're going to do it again, you know? Like, we're going to keep persevering. And it's like, he's the one that had to be, like, the scapegoat, that had to get fired, that had to be disappeared. And he seems like he's having a fine, good life, but I don't know. Like I said, there's that weird back and forth of, like, and it's something I don't think they hit at enough in like, good dramatic stories. You always have the reluctant hero, you know? It's like, I don't want to go back to that. I like my life dirt farming or whatever. And it's like, no, you don't, dude. Like, you're going to be the hero.
They should have killed him off.
Yeah, right, right. They should have had, like an assassin, snuff him out with a pillow.
Sean Bean always dies, yeah. But that would have been great if he just died right there in the credits. He gets hit with a golf ball in the head.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been good. So I don't know. I feel like kind of ambivalent, but also kind of glad that they did that sort of thing for his character, where it's like, you know, he could give a shit. He's out playing golf with his son.
Yeah. I mean, it's so lighthearted. I mean, what else are they gonna do?
But it was like, I don't know. I feel like it was a little bit purposeful that he was the one character that wasn't aware, wasn't watching it. Like, so they were making that point at least, which I liked. I thought, I mean, it's, you know, there's always something in a lot of movies every now and again where I see somebody just kind of show their hand a little bit about, like, considering something like that kind of aspect of it. And you're like, okay, that makes it better to me that they get that, you know, they get that he can't be part of that anymore. And he actually did the hard thing and is probably the only reason why any of it worked and anyone survived.
Yeah.
And why NASA, why they're doing another mission in the first place, probably, even, is all because of what he chose to do, and now he can't be part of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It was so lighthearted. I feel like they could just get away with whatever they wanted to do. So it's, I don't know. I don't think it impacted, like, my overall opinion of the movie. It was just, yeah, it was just the way it was. It was just, you know, I was just glad the disco jokes were over.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that did get a little weak and a little, like, kind of, frankly, a little nonsensical, because, I mean, that's so far removed that any music, certainly not music that's old to us, would probably be something that somebody who's hadn't been born yet, or is a toddler now, would be listening to. Yeah, it's sort of a cake and eat its two kind of thing there, I suppose. You know, like, well, we want it to be funny music like this, I guess.
Yeah, and if it's in 2030 or 2040, whatever year it's supposed to be, I mean, that's classical music by then. So
we've mostly been kind of nitpicky about it. Like I said, I think we both can agree that Scott generally puts together a pretty good visual thing. All the performances are good, I would say, for the most part. They know what they're doing, and they're, you know, good actors. So I didn't have a problem with that. I was engaged, and I enjoyed it as a first time watch. I think I gave it a 3.75 out of 5 stars for the experience of it, and for my own kind of, like I said, capitulating to my own sort of lack of cynicism for a little bit and being like, yeah, it would be nice to have a world like that where, you know, that works.
Yeah. Yeah. I think on my first time watch, I can't remember if I was on Letterboxd then. But I probably would have given it a 4. Like, I really enjoyed it on the first watch. I liked it, never loved it. I feel like I liked maybe Interstellar a little more comparatively. But on this rewatch, I feel like it dropped. I'd say I'm closer to where you're at now, probably a 3.5, maybe a 3. I felt like I was checking my phone a little more. I was like, "Yeah, I'm kind of rolling my eyes at some of these jokes and whatnot." But that's not the fault of the movie. So,
no, yeah, and I think it's always important for us as reviewers to be aware of our own mindset. And Zach always goes after me about that. He's like, "No, you should be able to watch it anytime, anywhere, but it should be at the big screen." I'm like, "I know. I didn't watch it on the big screen, so I sold myself. I probably would have been exactly where you were with it, with the higher level spectacle and engagement. It was totally meant to be seen on, you know, a big screen with full surround sound and all of that."
Yeah, I feel like I was telling people that, like, after I first saw Gravity, I was like, it's good, it's really good in the theater, so, like, if you're going to see it, you may as well see it while it's in theaters. I think this is probably close to that ballpark.
Yeah, I look at that now, because, I mean, at home I have a big enough screen, I sit close enough to it, and I'm engaged enough, and I sort of do things on my own terms in terms of watching it, you know, I can pause the movie for a second if I want to at a good breaking point and go do something else for a minute or whatever. Not that that's a fault of the movie necessarily. But yeah, I still do try to like make a point. Like with Gravity, I totally did, because I'm like, this is all in space and it's a like survival story. There were just too many things telling me, okay, I need to go actually see this.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I still will generally go force myself to go out and see the superhero movies at this point. I have not seen Suicide Squad yet. I don't know how. I wasn't one of those people that thought it could be like DC's Guardians of the Galaxy type weird and different enough. But now that it's come out and there's been sort of a real backlash about it, I don't know if I'm going to go into it and actually like it more than I was expecting. Who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Like, when I hear like a proper comic book nerd talk about a comic book movie compared to somebody like the Film Junk guys, for instance, who maybe aren't comic book nerds, and what they thought about Suicide Squad, they rated it much higher than I thought they would. I wasn't a big fan of it. I think I gave it like a 1.5, maybe a 2. If Will Smith had not been in it, it would have been a half star. I felt like it was pretty bad. I mean, I read Batman, so maybe I'm a little too snobby up that scale, but that plays into that, but it's just hard for me to, you know, put that behind me, because there is an element of Batman in Suicide Squad. He has a, you know, spoilers, he has a piece in throughout Suicide Squad.
The only reason I go see it.
And that was the only reason I probably went to see it. I could have waited, and I probably should have. But, yeah, it was nothing to get excited about or run out and watch, for sure.
I don't know with all the Batman stuff. I'm so behind on the comics right now, and I just kind of sort of stopped with most of my comics. Like, I'm going to catch up on the reading of that I have and finish up the Snyder run and everything else, but... I mean, when DC finally decided to do what I always knew they were going to do and just be like, yep, we're going to restart everything back over to what it always was before with our rich 75-year history, you know, I'm like, okay, yeah, guys, great. You know, certain things will only last for a certain window of time. And I've been very much, I mean, I kind of like the idea of just being the guy that just reads Batman. That's pretty much the only, I think that's the only of, But then they've diluted that character almost as bad as Wolverine. Like, in the perfect world for the big two for Marvel DC, I would love to have every month have one Batman book and one detective book or something like that. You know, like two Batman books and like two X-Men books from Marvel and maybe one Spider-Man book. I would read those like back in the 90s style, but they've just gotten so nuts with everything and restarting the numbering every time because I guess it bumps their stats.
Yeah, I don't know as much about that. Yeah, I mean, I just finished, I guess it was volume 2 of, I'm pretty sure it was Snyder. It was Batman and Robin Eternal, New 52. And it just kind of didn't have my attention. So, I don't know, I finished it up, but it wasn't, like, Batman wasn't even present in it. It was kind of boring for those reasons.
I have no idea what's going on with any of that Batman and Robin Eternal. I've got them all to catch up and read. I haven't even read, I'm rereading the Snyder Capullo stuff now. And I hadn't even started the Endgame stuff. So basically, the last Batman story I read was like the end of the Zero Year stuff. So I'm kind of trying to play catch up on all that, and I'm just gonna probably plow through it. I'll probably just put on some creepy ambient music and drink coffee and some Saturday night and just plow through a bunch of it. I create my own atmosphere for when it's right to do. Right thing to make it so it's like, you know, better. I'm not gonna read Batman on a sunny Sunday afternoon. Maybe yeah. Hawkeye. I'll read Hawkeye then, you know.
Yeah, I'm pretty much Batman only, but I don't know. I just picked up the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I guess it's Alan Moore stuff, and started getting into that just because I kind of like the artwork of that style. It seems very like when I was growing up, first getting into comic books and stuff. But it's kind of interesting. I'm not deep enough into it to have an opinion yet, but that's what I'm on right now.
He gets pretty involved with it. I think I read the first two volumes, and then he maybe did a more recent one, or he did a one shot at some point. And at some point, it kind of fell off for me because it almost became like the mythology that he started delving into with like all these other characters and everything almost became like a Silmarillion level, like, kind of thing, where it was just, it started to feel like academia or something. And I'm like, this is made up stuff. It's not engaging me. I appreciate that somebody's that crazy to go with that and do that. But yeah, most of my opinion of most of Alan Moore's stuff is that his older stuff, I think, is better. And he kind of went off the rails at some point or got interested in doing it. I think his Swamp Thing is really good.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I think I like his Swamp Thing stories better than Watchmen. I could give or take Killing Joke. I think Killing Joke is an okay story, but I think it's hard to get past. Same with Arkham Asylum, the Morrison one, where it's like these are just one-shot stories that are, you know, they're good art, stuff happens in them, they're engaging, but they're not like the end-all, be-all, like, oh my god, those are the stories, they're the best. I mean, like, a lot of the, like, Batman writers that are just Batman writers, like someone like Doug Mensch and stuff, who wrote, like, Prey for, like, Dark Knight Returns, which was, like, a couple issues, or Legends of the Dark Knight. Like, that's a really good Batman story about, like, a year two type Batman, you know, with Captain Gordon and Hugo Strange. And it's like, no one talks about that hard. I mean, like, maybe deep cut people that are really getting into the Batman, they really know the comics will, but it's like, that's actually a really good Batman story. And yes. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I haven't gotten into that, and you might be a little more deep cut to me compared to me. So, but I agree for the most part on Moore and his stuff. Like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is it's way darker than I thought it would be. I mean, like the Invisible Man is like, you know, basically they catch him and he's like essentially like, I guess he's raping a bunch of schoolgirls in a like a private school or something, and they just like go out and catch him. He's just some like sexual deviant that they recruit, and that's how they find him. And I was like, all right, I didn't see that coming, but either way, yeah.
I don't know what to make of that. I think that's always kind of been my problem with Moore stuff to a degree, and even in like Watchmen, where it's, I mean, my big thing is I think maybe because just the way the climate is, you know, sociopolitically, I feel like maybe I have more in common with villains, but I want to understand villains, and not every story needs this. You can have your mustache twiddling, you know, villains in the right context of stories, but someone like the comedian in Watchmen sort of almost like going so far as to like be pro-Nazi just didn't make any sense. It was just like, this guy's just an awful person. It's lazy writing, you know. I mean, I don't know. I like, for the most part, I like more interesting antagonism. I mean, like, where the Joker is interesting to me with Batman is that he's representative of, I mean Moore hits on it too, to his credit, in the Killing Joke, of like kind of the other way you take the way the world, you know, the world fucks you over, fucks everybody over, and then you either go one way with it or you go the other way.
Yeah. And have you seen the Killing Joke animated movie yet?
No, I haven't, and I've heard some things that kind of sour me about it. Like, it sounds like they try way too hard to R-rate it up.
They do. And it's pretty
and it sounds like it's got Conroy and Hamill doing the voices, which might just be like, I don't want my precious Batman the animated series to be contaminated with something that almost feels like it tries to fit in the canon of that, because it's got their voices, and it's like, oh, well, if you know about Batman Beyond, you know that there was some weirdness with Barbara and Bruce, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I might, if I'm in the right mood for it, but
yeah, I wouldn't run out to see it for sure. But yeah. I think your gut is pretty close to what it is.
And I mean, I don't know. It's just I thought it was going to be his last, but I guess Tim came back to be involved with the Killing Joke, which I guess I could see just because it's one of those iconic stories. But when he did the Dark Knight Returns, you know, the 3-hour long epic animated version of that or whatever, I don't know if it's quite that long, but And then it ends and, you know, Bruce Wayne's like, good enough. I'm like, that to me felt like that was Tim saying, like, probably what he said a million times making that story over the years of doing Batman, you know? You know?
Yeah.
Probably never happy with it, but always kind of like, yeah, it's good enough.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was like both of them, that character and everybody else together saying, good enough, you know?
Yeah. They were, it must have been a long production or something. Yeah. It was kind of,
yeah.
It felt that way. With what they come up with, but I don't know.
I mean, that's just such an amazing translation of that story. And it just reminds me, I mean, like, I don't know if you've ever listened to like Grant Morrison. Like, I read Grant Morrison's book about superheroes and stuff, which is a really good read, actually. It's kind of autobiographical, but it's also like, I think he spends a whole chapter just talking about the first page of Watchmen. And he gets into, because he really does a good job, I think, of contextualizing what's going on. Because people, I think, oversimplify like the Dark Knight Returns as being like a gritty Batman sort of thing, and it's got that, but Morrison completely understands everything that's going on with it in terms of, you know, he's on a horse and he's like, you know, and then he defeats a god at the end and everything, and it's like, yeah, you're right, all that stuff happens in that story, that's amazing. It really is this like, you know, and I think in my Letterboxd review I said it's like the definitive conclusion to the Batman thesis, you know, the thesis of the guy who is destroyed at 8 years old and decides, I'm going to try to make the world better on my own terms, whatever I can. You know, it's the Citizen Kane thing. I mean, like, that to me is super compelling because Batman doesn't even really feel like a hero. A lot of people say he's an anti-hero, but anti-hero is a problematic thing, which is why, as you know, if you've listened to the podcast, I have that outlaw hero term I like to use, which I swear to God I read in like a proper academic, like, paper in a film class once, and it was all about the idea of like the Western type hero, like the Clint Eastwood sort of characters that aren't really like, you know, they don't have the badge, or maybe even like the High Noon guy, you know, he gives up the badge and all that kind of thing. And then how that translated into as those kind of fell out during the war and everything in terms of cinema into the, you know, the Philip Marlowe type of characters, the private eyes that aren't actually part of the police, but navigate that dark world of vicious people, but they're not really the bad guys either. Like, I think to me, I would always say, like, you can do it with two Clint Eastwood characters. You know, your anti-hero is your Bill Money or whatever.
Yeah, Unforgiven, yeah.
From Unforgiven, where to its sort of cheap credit. And I like Unforgiven a good bit. And that's one with a great villain. The Gene Hackman character, I think, is really compelling. You just hear all about the awful shit he did, you know? So you never really see him be all that bad a guy. But, okay, he did all that awful shit, and now he's trying to do something sort of right for whatever reasons. So, okay, he's an anti-hero, you know, a character that eventually does something right but has been a very bad person in a very objective way. But then, like, Callahan, you know, Dirty Harry is, I mean, he's a cop technically, of course, but he sort of does what he needs to do to get through things. And so I think those to me are the two more interesting kinds of characters. I'm more interested in that outlaw hero term. And I think it bugs Zach because, I don't know, because because he's jealous that he thinks I made it up.
Yeah. He wishes he thought of it. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I thought of it. I swear to God, I read it somewhere. Maybe somebody else. Well, that shit's all bullshit anyway. It's all taxonomy, you know. but I think I can articulate it, you know.
No, you've made valid arguments and a convincing case for it. So I don't think you have to sell me on it. So
well, that's good.
I can go back to the tape. Yeah.
Yeah. Go back. Check the tape. Yeah.